This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 12th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, our roving reporter David Pleasant heads to Turin to visit the city's Paratissima design show.
I think Torino is a small city compared to other bigger towns in across Europe, for example. You have a chance to get on the spot. So this small dimension is not a limit, in my opinion.
Our very own Aled John heads to Paris to meet with rising design star Pauline Deltour.
Working for him, we have a lot of responsibilities and we are involved in the project from A to Z, from the very beginning.
And then we're back in London, where I'll be talking to Monocle's creative director, Rich Spencer Powell, about Sweden's new brand identity. It consists of the nation's flag. Genius or just lazy? That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. All that coming up. But first, let's cross to David in Turin.
Turin, a city of roughly a million that sits on the banks of the great River Po, is a place that tends to shy away from the limelight, an inferiority complex derived from its proximity to fashionista Milan in neighbouring Lombardy, or perhaps a reputation as the grey, declining centre of the Italian car industry. Probably not. Once you get to know Turin, or Torino, you realise that the city and its citizens have always been busy working, innovating and creating to the highest of standards. It just isn't in the Torinese's nature to brag about it. So Monocle is going to do a little bragging on Turin's behalf. In 2008, Turin was chosen as the world's very first capital of design. This came 2 years after the city hosted the Winter Olympics. And the momentum seems no sign of fading. And the city's industrial heritage continues to provide a source of authenticity and inspiration to the countless of designers that set up shop or studio here. We're going to meet some of the people that have been key to putting Turin on the map and making sure it stays there. High up on the cultural agenda is Paratissima. Now in its fifth year, the fair was set up as a fringe event to Artissima, the international contemporary art fair held in the city at the same time. Now Paratissima has a sizable design element, and has become a prime focus for many of the city's designers to show off their wares. I went along to the show to meet some of the people involved.
My name is Matteo Lucchini. The idea behind the project of Officina Caplavour is a workshop that we organized together with Politecnico di Torino University and 26 Chinese students coming to study in Italy. And the idea was to create working with some craftsmen of our network to create some objects that were dealing with the Chinese heritage, cultural heritage, melting with the Italian tradition. And so what I'm missing from my home country and what I can find and melt with the culture of the country I'm living in. And so we realized together with the students six objects dealing with the life of a student living abroad, maybe in a small flat, running to university and needing to bring food or books or whatever, or try to cook in a totally, completely different kitchen. And so we have chopping boards that mix together the way of cooking of Italian cuisine with the Chinese tradition. So I think Torino is a small city compared to other bigger towns in across Europe, for example. But this small dimension can be a good thing, because in this small dimension you however have opportunities to play your role. And in some kind of way, thanks also to all these exhibition going on like Paratissima, you have a chance to get on the spot. So this small dimension is not a limit, in my opinion, especially if you think about the general situation in Italy. you have the opportunity to get on the step and say, I'm here. You can play your chance in Turin, I think.
At another stand, something of the unglamorous and more domestic side of Italian design is celebrated.
I'm Davide, and I work for Forum, which is a cultural center in Omegna, which is a little country on the north of Piedmont. And we work to collect a lot of objects about our activities, industries and so on. And they made from the beginning of the 20th century till now a lot of objects of the kitchen, especially.
And maybe for somebody who doesn't know that kind of history of homeware and kitchen utensils and kitchenware that Italy has, maybe tell us some of the names of the manufacturers and what they specialized in.
We have in Omegna some of the most famous in the world industries as Alessi, L'Agostina of the pressure cooker, Bialetti for the coffee makers, but we have a lot of other little industries like Agostino Cane, Calderoni, which produced in the beginning of the 20th century a lot of this kind of object for the kitchen and for the house.
And do you think that this important design, these design items, have been overlooked? They've been ignored, like people don't even consider them to be important design pieces because they're so used to them?
Yeah, maybe a lot of these objects we don't consider them like a design object because we have in our kitchen, our house, so it's quite normal. But if we look at the history from the beginning of the century, the 20th century, till the 80s, we can then pass through other realities which now create a design object of design. So history that begins from the beginning of the 20th century and continues till now.
That was Davide and Matteo at their design stands in the Paratissima Fair. If anybody were to mention the words design and Italy in the same sentence, then no doubt one city would spring to mind, Milan. This predominance applies particularly to the world of fashion and design retail. However, Turin, just 45 minutes by high-speed train from Milan, is quickly becoming a retail mecca for those with an eye for good design. Unlike Milan, Turin does not show off its goods ostentatiously. Boutiques, workshops and showrooms abound, but are often hidden. The Turinese tend to keep their suppliers and retailers like a closely guarded secret. Discerning, discreet design defines Turin. First stop on my hunt for the best places to part with your euros in the city is the brand new Into the Wild shop on Via Accademia delle Scienze, number 2, just behind Piazza Castello.
My name is Fabio Raffaelli. We are in central Torino, in Piemonte, in Italy. And we are in my store called Into the Wild.
And we're upstairs in the women's section. And tell us a little bit about the design concept. There's a lot to describe, so maybe pick a few items or pick the idea behind the interior here.
Okay, the whole idea behind it was to combine whatever I experienced in the last 2 years. So basically I collected all the furniture that I had in my house in Berlin, in my house in Helsinki, and I moved everything here to give like a super personal touch to my new store, which opened on September 14th. Torino has been like a very conservative city for many years, but after 2006, when we had the Winter Olympics, everything changed. And so we have a lot of like international crowd right now. There's a lot of people moving on purpose because they feel the energy, you know, the positive energy of what is going on right now. So that's why we have, for the first time, people are actually taking a lot of care and attention to all these kind of details, you know, starting from design to contemporary art. And that's outstanding for us. Torino is also called the Black City because we have a very strong black magic history. And what is funny is that, you know, people are trying to be like, you know, very colorful, you know, they're trying to be like individuals, you know, outstanding individuals when it comes to style. But I can tell you that black is always the new black here, you know.
And if we look around, that's the kind of color that dominates, with kind of little patches of patterns and things, but there is a kind of a black thing going on.
Well, I feel that in the women's selection, for example, we're focusing a lot on Scandinavian design. And, you know, it's like very classic, very straight lines, and there's a lot of black and gray. And, you know, that's what people really appreciate here. There's a lot of subcultures, you know, booming. And that's why we have a lot of people from foreign countries actually choosing to live here in Torino, you know, because they feel the positive energy of, you know, what is going on right now. See, I keep repeating this all the time. You know, if I had to pick one city to live in Italy, that would be Torino.
Now we head north of the center to the Vankilia district of the city, where former industrial workshops and tenement housing now host a gaggle of new design, architecture and creative studios. At Corso San Maurizio, number 73B, is Tom Design. A small but superbly stocked shop, it sells some of the best design items you'll find anywhere.
My name is Giorgio Zella and the shop is Tom Design. The name Tom Design comes from times ago I did a little object in ceramics and decided to print it as Tom Design because Tom was our former dog. And now we have another dog, Molly. And
she's wandering around.
Yeah.
And walking into this space, it's quite a discreet space. You've got two windows onto the street, but it could be quite easy to miss. Tell us a bit about how you've curated this space and the objects that you've chosen.
The idea at the beginning was to make a shop in some way like a gallery, and so to put the focus, the attention on the object, trying not to overcrowd the space. We were quite bored of the Italian production in design. Always we looked at different production in Europe. And at the end, decided to try to propose to the public different design, not quite different by the usual Italian design. We are quite happy.
Next, we follow the course of the Dora, Turin's second river. At Lungodora Coletta, number 113, is the Texitalia clothing factory. It also has a large boutique, selling some of its wonderful jersey material productions, including those in the Harris Wharf collection that it sells in Paris, Tokyo, and at another boutique in London. Inside, fashion and industry seem to work in perfect harmony.
I'm Giulia Chiardi, and I'm the designer and the creative director of the brand Harris Wharf. I founded it with my brother in 2009, and together with our shop in London, and my shop in Turin. For me, every day is learning something. And that's very good because, especially in the pattern cutting and the design, everything has to be very close. So that's the best thing about living in Turin and staying in the contact of the factory. Of course, to design, I have my own moment. I have to concentrate on books and exhibitions, but still is very strong the connection between how I would like to see something and how to realize, so how to make it work, because sometimes it's a bit hard. But that's very challenging, and that's why I'm based in Turin rather than in London, because London for me is just to get ideas, to get the mood, to constantly try to develop it in my shop and get feedbacks for my customers and see how I'm doing. But Turin is so important to develop my ideas. And it's also very good because in Turin for me is like a capsule where I can stay concentrated and work. So the mood of Turin is always very conservative, never show off, so always try not to catch the eyes of anybody. And you can see it on my pieces because they are very minimal, also with the raw edge technique. We do a lot on coats and jacket. It makes everything very neat, clean. Also the lines, I usually work in volumes, so rather than on details. I love to put details, but when there is a minimal volume and also the selection of fabric has to admit a detail. Otherwise, if the fabric is already special, for instance, I never like to put, you know, too much. So I'm always very concerned about balancing well a fabric with a volume.
That was Giulia Archiadi, designer at Harris Wharf, which makes women's wear and men's wear here in Turin. It's hard to deny that design and the design community is now seen as one of Turin's strongest assets. The city has invested heavily in making sure that this resource develops and sustains itself long into the future. One way in which the local authorities have done this is by providing for the next generation of designers and supporting the city in attracting talent to learn and practice different design specializations. At IAD, the Institute of Applied Art and Design, the city has facilitated the expansion of this privately run design academy that recently moved into a gleaming new campus. I went back to school for a morning to find out what it takes to be a good designer.
I'm Laura Milani. I'm the director in IAD from a lot of years. City is and was the city of industrial design in Italy, and it's right because this approach is transversal, and it's very important for us to use this approach to explain that design is an approach that you can use not only in a city in Italy or, but to think and to understand and to interpret the possibility to share this approach with other skill, for example, contemporary art or architecture. So in my opinion, at the moment, if you would like to share experience, this is the best way.
What's the outlook for them? Do you feel that there's a good future for them here in Italy?
My approach with students is you have to be curious, you have to be proud, and you have to understand that this world can be really interesting, but in the global sense. If you think in this direction, this is really a good work for the future, a good point of view. If you would like to remain in a city, in one place, if you are not so sure about your future, this can be your problem. So the approach is fundamental to develop the right thing for the future and also to be an open professional.
My name is Camille Brito Reale and I study interior design. I'm not from Turin, I'm not Italian. I came from Venezuela, although I've travelled a bit before, so I wasn't in Venezuela before I came. I came to Turin for the university, but to be honest, I really like the city as well. It's a city full of design, full of events, and it's a young city as well. You have a lot of events for young people that of all sorts, and I like that kind of melting pot experience that you get here in Turin.
I'm Antonio Dieter Levi. I'm from Italy, and I started studying here in IAD since 3 years ago. Since I was a child, I think that I will be an inventor. After some years, I understand that there is no inventors in the world, and there's the designer. So I start to searching for design school, design process, and design education. I found IAD one of the best school. Because it's not only a school, it's an instrument.
I'm Carlo Liotta and I'm studying communication and graphic design. In a certain way, I feel pessimistic about my future because, understandably, there are a lot of problems, politics, economics, but I think that we have a big background behind us, and I think it's the only way we can be successful. I travel a lot, and every time I travel, a lot of people say, "Oh, you are from Italy, Rome, it's magnificent, all the design." So I think this is the first step we can just go forward this big period of crisis.
It's a new kind of challenge, but I think it's one of the things that's going to take Italy to a new level, and it's going to bring it up to the level of other countries that are now a bit more advanced.
That was the director and some of the students at Turin's IAD, Institute for Applied Arts and Design. From car design to graphics and architecture, It's easy to believe that Turin's designers are quietly excelling in just about everything they do. And in the bars, trattorias and piazzas, little of the foreboding talk that consumes many colleagues working elsewhere in Italy. Come rain, and it does rain a lot here, or shine, the Torinese seem to have a convivial and workaday charm. Finally, as part of our focus on Turin design, I went to the studios of some of those designers that are making the city an Italian success story. The first is graphic designer Roberto Necco, who busies himself hand-drawing some of Turin's most prominent cultural campaigns, and happens to play the banjo too.
Torino is a really is a very understated town. It's a town that don't love to do big expression of communication. But this is nice because at the end this sense of understatement, I think it's really eradicating this town. And I think it's if I have to say what is the characteristic of this town that influenced my work, especially probably is the understatement, the sense of doing something real, something I don't know how to say, but qualcosa di concreto.
Something concrete.
Something concrete, yes.
It's been said that one of the main components of love is mystery, and I think that is probably one of the reasons why it's so easy to love Italy and to love Turin, because nobody knows what is going to happen. It's very difficult to predict just who's going to be the president in a year or in 6 months. You know, things change so fast. It's ironic because things change fast and things don't change at the same time. I personally feel great. We haven't been busier than we've been in the past 4 months, 3 months. There's a lot of energy, there's a lot of desire to do things, and not necessarily from us or just from colleagues, creative colleagues, but I see it in clients. I see the small and medium-sized company and entrepreneur really taking the time to see opportunities in the crisis. And the people that I talk to and the clients that we have, I think that we all share that kind of energy and will to move things around, to look further, to look deeper, and to make things work.
That was designer and creative consultant Vladimir Sotto speaking from his Immaginato studio here in Turin. Understatement with a passion for experimentation seem to be the main driving forces behind Turin's diverse design community. And in many ways, it is this reserved, considered nature that has led, in part, to Turin weathering the economic storm that has struck so many design professionals in the rest of Italy. High-quality, sturdy designs that have heritage and pedigree is what Turin has always sold the world. Even as less cars and products roll off the factory floor, Turin is managing to capitalize on its expertise and technical know-how. The city and its designers have a confidence that comes from tried and tested methods. A little bit grey, maybe, but you might well be forgiven for thinking that Turin is Italy's brightest spark. For Monocle in Turin, I'm David Pleasant. Now back to Tom in London.
Thanks, David. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly programme on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Next, an opportunity for us to profile a designer on our radar and take a peek into their studio. This week, we're in Paris. Pauline Deltour is one of the rising stars of design, residing in Paris since 2010, a year after opening her first studio in Munich. Munich framed the first steps in her career, for it was there that Deltour worked for industrial designer Konstantin Grzycz. Now head of her own practice, the French designer finds inspiration from diverse disciplines, as she tells Section D producer Aled John.
Working for him, we have a lot of responsibilities and we are involved in the project from A to Z, from the very beginning. It's a lot of various projects. I mean, I could work on cutlery and gallery pieces. I've been 5 times to Japan. I've been working for 2 years and a half for a great seat for outdoor seat for Vitra, and I did some little marble piece for a gallery in Istanbul. I mean, that was a great variety of projects. And the thing I learned the most is that you have to reinvent yourself for all the projects. For any project, you have to rethink your process of working.
Did your time in Munich inform your multidisciplinary approach to design?
I could not see myself now working on one type of objects. What I like the most is working one day for a space project and the other day for a USB key or very small, tiny object you place in your pocket. It's the change of scale, change of materials. Also, the different people you're talking with and you're working for is something very challenging and very you learn every day and makes you more and more rich and also able to answer any question and to solve any problem. What I really like is the variety and challenge it brings, and because you have to adapt for any new project, you have to adapt yourself and find a way to answer a question. I'm working at the moment on a hard drive, on a collection of small pieces in silver for a great French company. I'm working, and these are two projects I'm working for a year and a half now, so it's a very long-term project. And it's also like relationships you create with the client, with people, so it becomes very, very interesting. I'm working also for furniture, for La Redoute, furniture which a few months ago I thought I was not able to do, but once again, like diving into the subject, you found your way to do things. I'm working on wallpapers and like a space for a great luxury company. So it's like very wide.
If we could talk about some of the projects you have released in the last year, the Black Clock, for instance, mm-hmm. Where did you get the idea for that?
It's a self-initiated project. I mean, I was asked to do a few pieces for the exhibition called Nouvelle Vague for Milan this year. And that was the first time for me to make some object without having a client, which was very difficult, because I hate that, actually. I like having a brief and having a client and having a real reason to do things, to create things. So for me, working on this with this white virgin piece of paper was like a big challenge.
Why did you hate that?
I like having direction and constraints, like having, okay, you need to work with this material and to do... We need a tray, or we need furniture, we need, I don't know, I like having like limits and trying to be as free as possible within these limits. So I gave myself some limits to start working on this Nouvelle Vague project. And I thought I would work with glass, because I've never worked with glass, and it's I really like materials, and it's a material I've never worked with. And I thought, okay, let's give myself the opportunity to work with glass. And I was very inspired by all the cinetic art. So I did some research. I'm always looking a lot at images and art pieces. I'm going to exhibitions. I gathered a few images. And I don't know, the clock was... I wanted to make a clock. And I thought, let's make a clock that you have to guess a bit what time is it. I wanted to have a clock where light is giving you the time.
Can you describe the clock to us? It's difficult for people to imagine it without seeing it, but if you could maybe talk through why you took that approach and what the finished article looked like.
Well, the key piece, the key element of the clock is this piece of two-way mirror, which is in the front of the clock. And the two-way mirror is a piece of glass, which is when the back of the mirror is not lit, it stays a mirror, and when you lit the back, it becomes transparent. So I just put some LEDs on the two ends of the hands of the clock, and then you can see the numbers appearing on the pieces of glass, and you can guess what time is it.
Should we go through to your studio and have a look at some of the projects you're working on?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I can show you can show you first the I'm working on the bag as well for discipline.
So these are the prototypes?
Yeah.
Describe them to me.
Well, that's for the brand discipline. Renato Preti, sorry, asked me to work on the bag for the weekend. He asked me to design the most beautiful bag. That was the brief.
So you said before that you like constraints and limits.
Yeah.
That's quite a broad description of what he wants, is it not?
He gave me a brief with telling me, okay, we need to work with natural material, leather and cotton or linen. It has to be a beautiful bag that people can use for the weekend, so like a two, three days travel. And that was, yeah, that was the brief.
That was Pauline Deltour talking to Section D producer Aled John in her studio on Rue de Faubourg Saint-Martin. Coming up, we review Sweden's new national brand identity, which looks suspiciously like the yellow and blue flag with the word Sweden next to it. And we take a look at the architect-designed dolls' houses before they go under the hammer at London's Bonhams. But first, San Francisco is still recovering from last month's America's Cup yacht races, one of the oldest sailing competitions in which two performance boats battle it out for the old mug, a trophy steeped in tradition and jealousy. This year saw Oracle Team USA perform an amazing comeback, beating Emirates Team New Zealand in a race of fast, slick catamarans. Critics, however, have described the engineering design of these yachts as having more to do with aeronautics than boat building. These vessels have been built to minimise friction, deal with the turbulence of tides and winds, and be completely aerodynamic. And although designers have accomplished exceptional machines for speed, many insist that the romance, the beauty of the sailing boat against the horizon, has been entirely sacrificed for the sake of competition. Auckland's Federico Monsalve set out to discover simpler and perhaps slower times for maritime design. He met with historian Harold Kidd and two others who are battling to maintain and expand traditional wooden boat-building aesthetics in the island nation.
Well, I think one of the things you've got to say about local boat design is that there are several influences or threads to it. And for example, the local fishing boats, which became known as mullet boats and snapper boats, had form following function. The mullet boats here were designed for shallow water and therefore were centre boarders. They had to be able to be rowed around, row the nets around, so they had to be easily handled by a couple of men with sweeps. The men had to go out and stay out overnight, so they had a cuddy forward so that the men could sleep out of the weather. And they had a primitive form of fireplace so they could cook their food. And then they had to get back quickly to the market. There was no ice industry then, so they had to get back smartly. And because most of the, in Auckland, most of the fishing grounds for mullet, which were very prolific at that time and of great eating, was to the east and therefore downwind of the prevailing westerlies, they had to be good going to windward.
It wasn't long until amateur sailors in the late 1800s Auckland began to see the potential of these boats as something other than just a fishing tool. And the infamous mullet boats, the large keel ships used to catch deep-sea fish, and other such work vessels were redesigned for speed.
If a wealthy amateur, a banker or a brewer or somebody, built one of these mullet boats for racing, they could always be sold to fishermen afterwards.
Oh, right.
So there was and fishing boats could come back and be rigged as yachts. So
you mean the breed of both racing boats and fishing boats were benefiting from this exchange of ideas and design techniques that were being passed back and forth?
It was part of an egalitarian thing too. There was a good camaraderie amongst the fishing people and the local bourgeoisie.
As boats increasingly became a source of entertainment, local craftsmen began to look outward. And at that early stage of the industry, most ideas were not necessarily vernacular.
We get a lot of people here who were designing eclectic boats that had elements of design from the United States, from the UK, and weren't really anything to do with local conditions, except that they worked.
That was, however, until the arrival of two boat design families that came to revolutionize the way local boat builders approach their craft. The Logans and the Baileys are more often than not mentioned in the same breath. Two large families full of competitive sons who took to the family business of boat building, and by the late 1800s brought New Zealand to its early peak in yachting design. Building techniques such as the multiple skin diagonal were being adapted to suit local conditions and proved to be great for the strong and highly coveted native local timber from the kauri tree. The Logans in particular are still paramount in local maritime design mythology.
They built some of the nicest looking boats around. The Baileys were there as well. And then there was Charlie Collings and Alex Collings, who built beautiful launches and designed these boats. And they had 22-foot mullet boats, which were the open boats. They really got boating alive in New Zealand.
That is Robert Brooke, the head of the New Zealand Traditional Boat Building School, a stunning woodworking academy on the outskirts of Auckland, where both professionals and amateurs come to learn the basics of wooden boat building. Caulking, carvel planking, lofting, and basic designing are some of the casual classes taught here, which eventually lead students to launch their own small sailing gems into Auckland's harbour.
This is your main workshop here with the machinery and so forth all by itself. And we come into here, and what you can see here is not one boat's the same. We're looking at clinker dinghies made out of kauri. We're looking at clinker dinghies made out of plywood. You're looking at plywood boats. And then you've got a little sailing boat here. And you go on down, and we come to a sunburst down there. Now, sunburst in New Zealand started in 1963, and they're having their 50th anniversary this year. And there's 2,000 of them in New Zealand, so they add up. And then you've got a kayak down here. And you know, it's just, we'll go down to the next room. Here's a canoe that's been done in veneer. It's an overseas design. And then you've got an old clinker dinghy that someone has had. Obviously built overseas, a big solid clinker dinghy. And we get the feeling in this place here on a night when it's all humming, it's just magnificent.
Fantastic.
They love it.
One of the things you've got to think about with New Zealand is that we don't throw stuff away. Well, certainly the generation I came from didn't throw stuff away, because a large number of us came from farming backgrounds, non-urban. A lot of us were from stock who'd come out here in sailing ships. A lot of us had been through First World War, when we'd lost a huge number of our young men in France, in Gallipoli. Then they had a depression. So there'd been a lot of tough times. And we also we were at the arse end of the world, to put it bluntly. So everything we imported had a transport content and a duty content. And so, you know, with things like motor cars, it was quite common to drive a 30-year-old car. And it was very common to have a 50, 60, 100-year-old boat.
In here, the feel is one of old age and tradition. Besides a simple swivel stove for cups of tea, some intricate glasswork on a sky panel, everything seems to be built for speed and not much comfort. There's a smell of solid, dry timbers and salt air, and above my head, in copper wrought holders, sit eight small gin glasses slightly clouded by age.
They were renowned gin drinkers. Those glasses are what the old boys used to use, and that's back probably in the war years.
So
they're still on board. Oh, the stories this thing could tell if someone had a tape recording would be mind-boggling.
For Monocle, I'm Federico Monsalve.
Coming up, we take a peek behind the doors of 20 architect-designed dolls' houses.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
When Martin Evans decided to raise some money for the disabled children's charity Kids, he couldn't face the idea of running a marathon or climbing Everest. Instead, he thought he would use his connections in the world of architecture. As creative director of Property Developers Cathedral Group, he naturally had a lot of them. And so he asked a few architects to each design a child's doll's house for a private auction. 1 year later, and Martin has 20 doll's houses designed by some of the biggest names in world architecture, including Zaha Hadid and David Adjaye. As you might expect, these aren't your ordinary doll's houses. You won't find any kitsch miniature furniture or floral wallpaper here. The designs are all unconventional and contemporary, and they all have at least one feature which makes life easier for a child with a disability. Monocle's Matt Alagaya went to have a look and catch up with Martin Evans, the man behind this exciting new project.
I'm Martin Evans. I'm the creative director at Cathedral Group, and we're a property developer, and we spend our lives working with architects. Three of my colleagues also have families with disabled children in them. And so last year, when one of my colleagues had a new baby who had some difficulty, when he came back to work, he told us about this amazing charity called Kids, who helped him and his family hugely through their difficult time. So we resolved that we would raise some money for them. And I decided as my contribution that I would do what I know how to do, which is work with architects and designers. And so I asked two or three of the architects who work with us to make a doll's house. And they said yes, and I thought that's quite easy. So I might ask some more. And I did, and nobody said no, and now we have 20, including houses from Zaha Hadid and David Adjaye and Ken Shuttleworth at Make, and 17 other incredible artists and designers.
One of the things that I've noticed is that I don't think I would recognise any of them as a doll's house, as I know it. But I was wondering, how sort of open was the brief?
There was no control over the brief at all. It was completely open. They were given a size of a plinth to work with, and they were all asked to make one element of their house something that would make life easier for a child with a disability, either to live in such a house or to play with it. I mean, we asked 20 reasonably contemporary architects, and so I'm not surprised that we got 20 contemporary dolls' houses. But what's been interesting about that, as you say, is that it's not what you would expect from a doll's house. Doll's houses are typically Victorian confections with frilly curtains and lacy furniture and wallpaper. There's not a single piece of wallpaper, I think, in any of the houses downstairs from here. They are all contemporary, they're all unusual and odd, and they all are particularly typical of the work of each architect that's made them. So Zaha Hadid's house is very typically a Zaha Hadid design. It's a beautiful object that is at once a building and at once a plaything. And it's very interesting. It's made of building blocks, and you take it apart and you put it back together, and there are endless configurations of the pieces that are a plaything, but also, as she says, help you to understand the relationship between voids and forms in building. So something that teaches you something about contemporary building, I think.
So Martin, talk me through this one. This one looks amazing. It actually looks like a house, unlike some of the others.
Well, it is a house. This is Compass House. It's designed by AHMM, Olfert Hall Monaghan Morris, and it's my favourite. It's a beautiful house that is based on a real house that they designed, and it's a particularly modernist confection, very typical of their work. Its colour scheme particularly is exactly what they do at AHMM. And the colours and the textures in here are specifically designed to answer the brief about this being effectively a toy or something for a child with maybe a sight impairment, because you can touch it, and not very good for radio, but you can touch it and see it, and it's full of textures and colours and surfaces. It's just a lovely, beautiful... I suppose this is probably the most like a house of all of the dolls' houses, I suppose.
I was going to say, I could happily live in that. It looks very, very comfortable.
Me too. Well, there's more than one bedroom, so maybe we could share it.
Yeah. This one here. This one is one of the taller ones.
This one over here, one of the taller ones. Not the tallest. Lifshitz Davidson Sanderland's house is nearly 2.5 metres tall. This is by an architect's practice called HLM, and it's probably the most sensory of them. It's designed for a child with sight impairment, and so it's all about sound and touch. So it has dolls that live in the house, and this one that I'm holding now has got Braille on it. I think it says play with me in Braille on it. The house has got a series of ball bearings, metal and wood ball bearings all the way over it, and holes. And when you run the ball bearings through the house, they tinkle and jangle and make sounds and noises, and it's endlessly entertaining. As we found out the other night when we had our launch evening, children came. This is the one they all hung around and wouldn't leave alone.
Oh, really?
Fantastic.
Can you make it make a noise?
Yeah, absolutely. That would be fantastic. That was one of the metal ones.
It was.
Let's try a wooden one now.
Not quite so noisy.
That's very nice.
Nevertheless.
Yeah. Sounds very good. Finally, I think, let's talk about this one. This is...
So this is DRDH's Doll's House. It isn't actually a house. It's a theatre, a play theatre. It packs up, and then as you open it, it makes a tiny little theatre with working curtains and stages that move and seats that change. It's really the most delightful, wonderful, tactile, amazing thing that, again, if you are sight impaired, just by touching and feeling and understanding the relationship between the rooms and spaces in this house, you can understand how a building works. It's just endlessly beautiful and playful.
It sounds like a lot of the architects and designers really took the brief to heart and have come up with something really extraordinary here.
Well, they're competitive, those architects. So I think that they realised that they were up against 19 other of their competitors and they better do something extraordinary. And they all absolutely rose to the brief most magnificently. It's been a really wonderful project to see architects' minds thinking and solving creative problems. It's been a really wonderful thing.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Last week, the government of Sweden released its new brand identity. One year in the making, what it lacks in complexity, it certainly makes up for with originality. It being composed, well, of the Swedish flag and the word Sweden. Okay, maybe not originality then. As the creative director of Stockholm-based design agency Soda Havet, who were behind the new brand, knowingly said, it's audacious to choose such an obvious symbol as the foundation for an identity. Soda Havet were commissioned by the Council for the Promotion of Sweden. So, how does the new identity score? I'm joined by our creative director, Rich Spencer-Powell. Rich, what are your thoughts?
How does it score?
Actually, could you describe it to us first?
Okay, the description of it is, it's the Swedish flag, which if anyone isn't familiar with that, it's a yellow cross on a blue background, and that sits within a yellow box. It has the words Sweden and Sverige. I don't know if that's a correct pronunciation. It is simple. It's what you'd expect. It's essentially the Swedish flag, which I like. I like the Swedish flag. So in one sense, it scores quite highly. It isn't desperately original, but I think this is one of those design situations where, you know, I think design is a lot about decision making. And they've just made, I think, probably the correct decision in using the flag. But I don't know what else they would have done. And I think the great shame here is it's easy to say this is, you know, glaringly obvious and boring. But I think when they released it, I think they should have applied it to a few things. They should have put it on posters at Arlanda Airport, and they've designed a, you know, bespoke typeface. We should have seen the whole typeface, you know, all the characters.
Yeah.
And then I think you can get a little bit excited about it. But when someone says, hey, we've been in a think tank for a year and we've come up with the flag, which you've already got, it does smart a little bit of laziness and not genius, if you ask me.
Yeah. What do you think of the new typeface? Because that's the sort of the one bit of original flair on it.
It's okay. It looks Swedish to me. You know, I've seen lots of sort of Swedish typefaces over the years. They sort of try and break away from the sort of Swiss, German, Helvetica world and add a little thing on the side, a little quirky mini slab serif thing it's got going on. It's quirky. I think you'll tire of it, unfortunately, but it feels Swedish. So I guess it's a success there. I mean, I don't know if they were on an hourly rate, but I don't know why they couldn't
it's
have
a
just...
a lot of kroners.
I mean, if it was an hourly rate, I think 1 hour, and then you send your invoice. But, I mean, maybe that's the game.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, actually looking at it, when something like that is overused so much, I mean, what's the difference between that and IKEA's branding? Say, yeah. I mean, the Swedish, they do like to use their flag quite a lot in those colours.
They do. And I think nation brand is quite a difficult thing. It's quite difficult in the UK because I think the Union Jack is actually quite a hard flag to use. It's quite complicated. So often in the UK, it gets reduced. They make it, everyone seems to make it quite small. They don't want to make it big because it gets a bit brash. You know, in the States, they like their flag. It kind of, it's very symbolic and the stars and stripes are quite a fashionable thing. And I just think Sweden, it's really simple. It's really nice. So, you know, I think put a few more hours in. Time for another invoice, I think.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today on Section D. Thanks to David Pleasant in Turin and our other guests as well. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com. I'm Tom Morris. And a song to play you out. A duo that succeeds at flying the Swedish flag with some originality. Here's The Knife with Marble House. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.